To what extent does Job establish a firm link between the believer's hope and the resurrection and future life? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, as we continue our series on the book of Job. My conversation partners are again Dave Thomas, Dean of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Jen Ogden, Associate Pastor of the Walla Walla University Church. Let me come to that question. If you had the book of Job, where would you say the book of Job hints at or points to a future hope, resurrection, etc.?
Well, we talked about it where he talks about, yet in my flesh will I see God.
Mm-hmm. That's one, and we have a lesson coming up on that one.
But I also think that his profession of faith in God that results in his restoration is another one.
Yeah.
But you have another one in mind.
Well, there is a place, in chapter 14 where he suggests, that maybe there would be something there.
Well, in 13, I think he says, I will call and one day you will respond.
Yep.
He's looking forward to a response to his questioning.
And in this connection, intimations of hope, I want to focus in on one verse, which is really a fascinating one. Job 13:15. It can be translated in two quite different ways. One is more confrontational. The other one is much more gentle. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. King James Version. Or you could take NRSV that says, he will kill me. I have no hope. Yet I will defend myself to his face. Now, just for fun, I went to Bible Gateway, and you can look at all English translations there. And so I went through them. There are 51 English translations to see how many of them were affirming and how many of them were more confrontational.
Oh, of this verse?
Of this verse, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
33 were more affirming, and 18 were more jarring. Mm-hmm. So, now, I happen to prefer the jarring one.
Why?
Simply because I think that's what Job would say. He will slay me, I have no hope, but I will still defend.
Well, yeah, if you add that last phrase.
Yeah.
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 I will defend my own ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the interesting...
But how is that an intimation of hope, Alden?
That he will be vindicated in the end. Mm-hmm. Now, that still is not a vindication of a resurrection hope.
No. Mm-mm.
But it is a hope, at least, of some kind of vindication. But I want us to at least look for a little bit at those indications in the Old Testament that do suggest a trajectory towards a restored world. And here it's helpful to have a little bit of background from the Canaanite religion. Canaanite religion is not going anywhere. It's all cyclical and natural. So if you do your incantations right in the autumn and in the spring, then Baal will die in the spring, come back to life in the fall, and if he comes back to life, then you have rain during the winter. There are some fascinating stories in connection with this. And when Elijah goes in and confronts Ahab, he says, you can do all your incantations that you possibly want, but Yahweh is going to control the rain, and he's turning off the faucet. See? So you have that clear teaching in the Old Testament that Canaanites are not going anywhere. Every year is the same. Whereas, as the scholars would say, the Old Testament is linear and goal-oriented. It's not every year the same. There will be a kingdom that will be established. We look forward to the Messiah, the return. And in Christian terms, we would say the resurrection and restoration. So even though the Old Testament doesn't have that clear an intimation of the resurrection, it's still pointed that direction. And one of my favorite passages here is the Isaiah's vegetarian kingdom. Isaiah 11. The wolf shall live with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the kid. The calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young shall lie down together. And the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put its hand on the adder's den. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. See? They had never, ever seen a world like that. And we can't imagine it. You know, what does a vegetarian hawk look like, for example? See, I have no idea. But a world, a material world, where nobody eats anybody else, you know, that's really the way it ought to be. So this whole thrust of the Old Testament is that direction, but it still does not have clearly an indication for a resurrection. But now let me come in with another question for you. Paul says, 1 Corinthians 15:19, that if for this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. Would you agree with Paul? If we didn't have the resurrection hope, we would be of all people most miserable. There are people who argue Christian way is worth it just for its own sake.
But I think you could argue that from a lot of religious perspectives that aren't Christian, that their current life is the best life. You know, this idea of even resurrection life, that you earn a better life in your next life, and, you know, that you keep coming back until you get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Christian life, the joy is that we have hope now that carries us through, and we have hope in a future life that is far better than the one we experience now.
For me, having known about the resurrection means I agree with the Apostle Paul. If I lived in the Old Testament, I might not have agreed with him.
Hmm.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That once you learn about the resurrection and you see its significance and you connect yourself to the hope it brings, then I would say, yes, Paul is right. If that's only for the here and now, then I'm pretty miserable. I won't know it. I suppose, because if there's no resurrection, I'll be dead.
Yeah, it's clear once somehow the Old Testament people were able to live on, you know, and Abraham and others lived on through their children.
Well, but they were looking for, they had a promise, Alden.
What was the promise?
Well, the promise was somebody who would deliver them and somebody who, as you pointed to Isaiah, that they will bring us to a new way of living.
Yeah.
And so what's missing there is the statement of transition, other than the day of the Lord comments that you find in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's not until you get the New Testament that you get any detail on that.
And, of course, their understanding of a restored kingdom was significantly flawed because they expected a Messiah who would be a warrior Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, what do you do with Daniel talking about he'll be cut off? In the midst of the week, then one of his prophetic statements is that
Daniel 9 is a very intriguing passage.
Yeah.
But if you look at Daniel's situation, the only sanctuary he saw was the one that was destroyed by the Babylonians, 586.
Yeah, but I mean that the whole sentence, that whole thought, seems to have superlative overtones of some kind. I mean, they may not be as precise as we read back into it.
Yeah.
But it does look like he is looking beyond the here and now.
Yeah, there is a sense in which there's a forward movement there, yeah. Mm-hmm. But without the precision that we would really think so.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think there is a hope in the Old Testament. There is a hope. It's couched differently than ours.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that, Jen?
Yeah, I do. I think it's maybe not quite as on the nose as the New Testament and not quite as obvious, but I think that it is there, and I think it's very pervasive and persuasive. And I think that the people, you know, who lived then, while not maybe having the full picture, were living for something in a one day, in a future.
And I mean, what do you do with Job's statement? Even if you take the harsher reading, he will kill me and I will have no hope. I will defend myself. If I am dead, when will I defend myself?
Mm.
Well, that's one reason why he wants, the book is amazing because sometimes he says, why don't you back off for me and at least let me have some sleep and go to, then at least you can't beat up on me anymore. But there are other number of places where he says, look, we've got to sort this out because if I die, you won't have any more contact with me. Okay. So his whole story, I mean, his whole dialogue is really quite challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at his words, I mean, his defiance goes even deeper. This one, for instance, I think here in Job chapter 13, he's saying, listen carefully to what I say. Let my words ring in your ears. Now that I have prepared my case, I know I will be vindicated. Can anyone bring charges against me? If so, I will be silent and die. Only grant me these two things, God, and then I will not hide from you. withdraw your hand from me and stop frightening me with all your terrors. Then summon me, and I will answer, or let me speak, and you reply to me. How many wrongs and sins have I committed? Show me my offense and my sin. Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Will you torment a wind-blown leaf? Will you chase after a dry chaff? For you write down bitter things against me. You make me reap the sins of my youth. You fasten my feet in shackles. You keep close watch on all my paths by putting marks on the soles of my feet, so man wastes away like something rotten, like a garment eaten by moths. See? Incredibly intense.
Mm-hmm.
But lurking behind that is a man who still has hope.
So does Job establish a link between the believer's hope and the resurrection and future life?
Well, he would certainly be seen as one who is shares of that tradition of looking forward to some kind of restoration in the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it may not have the specificity
mm-hmm.
which we would have, but that is certainly the case that we would have. Now, there's one thing that's interesting, and we don't have a lot of time here, but it is, again, evangelicals have a hard time looking at the wisdom literature in the Old Testament with its skepticism. Walter Martin, for instance, he says it's almost universally agreed among biblical scholars that Ecclesiastes portrays Solomon's apostasy and is therefore virtually worthless for determining doctrine. That's quite remarkable for someone who holds to a high view of Scripture. But they would probably say certain things about also the nasty statements of Job, where he is being very confrontational as far as God is concerned. So, one last question. Does Job's defiant defense of his innocence before God give modern believers permission to do the same?
I wonder if we're ever at a point where we're quite as clear as Job that we're as innocent.
Maybe if we were in the midst of this kind of suffering, we would have that kind of clarity.
Maybe.
I mean, Job does a lot of processing of his own life and examining yeah. a lot, and he doesn't find anything.
And he has this astonishing statement. I will surely defend my ways to his face. Indeed, this will turn out for my deliverance, for no godless person would dare come before him.
Mm-hmm.
So he is convinced of his innocence, and he's going to stay with it. And that, I think, is very important. Well, our time is up. Thank you, Jen and Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we talk about the wrath of Elihu. Thank you to Jared, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.